Welcome to another episode of The Watchdog with me, Low Key, here on Mint Press, where we week in, week out, are investigating the structures of power which dominate our society and going against the grain by publishing stories that are often marginalized outside the eyesight and the earshot of the masses. And this week, we are here with a special guest who hopefully will be no stranger to our audience. And it seems he has published possibly a seminal text of our time on what exactly happened with the killing of Corbynism in this country. He, like me and many others, saw it as a window to a better world. We saw it as an opportunity to redistribute political, social, and economic power in our society. We saw it as an opportunity to widen political participation. We saw it as the chance of a lifetime. But our hopes were dashed. They were thrown, scattered into a million pieces and thrown into the wind. We saw people lose their livelihoods. We saw people lose their sanity. We saw people lose their reputations. We saw good people whose aim was only the betterment of their society lose everything they had as part of the killing of Corbynism. People were sacrificed. And Asa Winstanley, who is our guest today, has been relentlessly chronicling this process in granular detail. You have seen hundreds of vital stories to understanding what happened in this country during that time, published not just by him, but Electronic Intifada, other writers too, tracking bit by bit with true watchdog journalism in extensive detail what exactly was happening in the Labour Party. It was Asa who broke the story that Labour, under Keir Starmer, had employed a former agent of Unit 8200, the military intelligence signals communications unit of the Israeli military, which specializes in blackmailing Palestinians on information it has procured through surveillance of them, into Labour's office for the purpose of quote-unquote social listening. It was Asa that broke that story. It was Asa that broke the story about Ella Rose, who was a former employee of the Israeli embassy and went on to lead the Jewish labor movement. And it was Asa who broke the story about Gary Lubner, the new big-time funder of the Labour Party, who Asa has in the last week or so revealed to not only be a key Israel lobbyist, but also someone that benefited materially from apartheid South Africa. And now Asa has released this book, which it's essential that we read to understand exactly what happened to all of us and how the hopes and dreams of millions, not only in this country, actually, but across the world, trying to find a new way that this political unit that we call Britain can have some type of role in the world, which is not destructive and colonial and imperial. And we saw Corbyn as a chance for that. People across the world understood him as somebody who had been anti-colonial in his mindset at key points in his life. And they thought there was a chance for a better world. But all of that was dashed. What happened, Asa?
Yeah, that's a big question. I think we still don't fully understand what happened. I think we still don't fully know everything. I have tried to write this book as a first draft, really, a first attempt at writing the history of this. And I mean, they say journalism is the first draft of history, and that is what I'm trying to do here. I think that so many things have happened that we don't know about and that we won't know about probably for decades. I think that the role of the British deep state in combating Jeremy Corbyn is not fully known, and it won't be known for a while. And, you know, it may never be fully known. We can't say for sure. But some of it is known. So some of it was out there. But I think that the role of the Israel lobby was far more blatant. But they worked together. And so I think that I have tried to get across in my new book that aspect, how these different forces of the deep state really worked together. So the example that I opened the book with was when Corbyn was first running. I mean, it sticks in everybody's mind, but it's kind of, there were so many things that happened during Corbynism, for want of a better phrase, but I think it's a valid term. The British media went so crazy that it's hard to remember it all. And I've tried to bring it all together in a coherent narrative. So the thing that really sticks out in my mind, one of the things I opened the book with, is the Sunday Times story from 2015, when Corbyn was very clear he was going to become the leader of the Labour Party. A serving senior general in the British Army spoke to the Sunday Times. They didn't name him. No doubt it must have been him. I don't know of any serving senior female generals. He said that if Corbyn was to become prime minister, there would be effectively a mutiny. That was his words. There'd be rebellions on all levels. There'd be effectively a mutiny. And why was that? Well, that was because he was somebody who was close to the British peace movement. That's what it comes down to. He's an anti-war activist. And Britain's imperial role, Britain's role as an empire, is over in the sense of running its own empire, but it's now a vassal state of the American empire, in effect. And Corbyn is someone who has worked against that in his political life. So him becoming the leader of the country was just something unthinkable to these forces. I mean, look, even on the British left, we don't know the history of this country, of what the British government has done, what the British intelligence services have done, what the British military has done to undermine British democracy. The term deep state is used commonly by academics for countries like Turkey and Egypt. The term gets kind of a bad, it's been kind of devalued in recent years because Donald Trump has used it and people think it's some sort of conspiracy theory, but it's not that. And, you know, Donald Trump occasionally had a point about some of what he was saying, because there were elements, no doubt, of the American deep state that didn't like what he was doing. They would have preferred someone more like Joe Biden. On the other hand, Donald Trump did absolutely work to further, ultimately, American empire. There's no doubt about that. Like, you know, when he was saying that we're going to stay in northern Syria to keep the oil and all that kind of stuff, he assassinated the Iranian military commander and political leader, Qassem Soleimani, who's regarded as a hero by millions in the Middle East for defeating ISIS. Anyway, bit of a tangent, but the point is that the British deep state, that the term deep state is used for countries like Egypt and Turkey, because what does it mean? Well, it means the military and the security and intelligence, the spy apparatus, essentially, has a massive amount of influence on how the country is run, to say the least. It has a huge amount of influence. In Turkey, it's even reached the point where, in the past, the military has overthrown and had coups against the government. So, and similar things happened in Egypt as well.
Well, I mean, also you've got the example of Ramsay MacDonald when he was standing for prime minister on the Labour ticket. You had the Zinoviev letters that came out, which were supposedly from the head of the Communist Party in Russia, being sent to Ramsay MacDonald saying, "We are very excited for your election. We support you. We believe it will lead to greater relationship between the Soviet Union and Britain."
Yeah.
And then what comes out after it is that this was a hoax by what seemed to be MI5 officers at the time.
Yeah.
And then you have Harold Wilson. Which, you know, and Harold Wilson wasn't even a Corbyn. He didn't allow British troops to join the US.
He wanted to send British troops to Vietnam.
Well, He didn't in the end, thanks to public pressure, partly the Vietnam Solidarity Campaign. That, of course, then led to the spy corps and the Special Demonstration Squad and all of that.
But even he was too much for the British deep state. I mean, these are really good examples of how the fact there is a British deep state and it is still, it has long, long interfered in preventing democracy, really, in this country. And it's still doing that now. Yeah. It's still absolutely, there's no doubt that it's doing it now. And it was doing it quite openly against Jeremy Corbyn in some regards. Mm. Like just this story in the Sunday Times was just a signal. It was an open signal. It was a sign that they would take active measures. And so, you know, if that's what they were doing openly, we can only imagine what they were doing behind closed doors to sabotage this popular movement. And I think it's so important that we learn these lessons. And you know, I get into some of that in my book, but I think it's a far wider project of political education and self-education that we have to undergo, you know, in this country, especially that, you know, the British intelligence services are completely unaccountable. You gave the example of Harold Wilson, who was really on the soft left of the Labour Party. He was an imperialist. Really, essentially, he was an imperialist.
Responsible for Diego Garcia, you know, the depopulating of Diego Garcia and the handing over of it to the US as a military base.
And he was very pro-Israel as well. But because he had these, you know, moderately social democratic domestic policies, it was not enough for the British deep state. They worked against him, you know, and there's been some really good books about it. About the plot against Harold Wilson. There's a book called Smear by Robin Ramsey and his co-author. I forget the co-author. But, you know, these forces, the British spy agencies are completely unaccountable to any kind of democratic control. And they don't want that power taken away from them. And so they work to undermine these kind of popular movements from within because you can't stand up to people power. Ultimately, it can't be defeated, but it can't be defeated if it has solidarity, you know, if it stays unified. If it's divided against itself, then it can be defeated. And I think that's what we saw. And my book focuses on the Israel lobby. You know, the subtitle to Weaponizing Antisemitism in my book is How the Israel Lobby Brought Down Jeremy Corbyn. And that's not to say that they were the only factor by any means, but what the state of Israel and its lobby did was they provided the most powerful political weapon to the British deep state, to the American deep state, to the whole of the political right in this country to work against Corbyn. Everybody from the right wing of the Labour Party to the Conservative Party to the fascist right has this powerful weapon to say, you lot are anti-Semitic. You lot are the real racists. This is the idea because they're also devaluing and they're delegitimizing the whole concept of racism. You know, it's been the anti-racist movement has become so successful that, you know, popular movements over the decades, time and time again, the most recent one being Black Lives Matter, it's become so successful that it is a badge of shame, rightfully, to be racist in this country, but then you can still have the prime minister, the former prime minister of the country, saying openly racist things and not being held to account for it. And obviously, I'm talking about Boris Johnson. And I won't repeat some of the things he said because they're really disgusting. But there was never any accountability for him. And now they're sort of trying to find him guilty of having a party here and there, which I don't think most people care about, to be frank with you. Although, you know, obviously there was lockdown going on. And, you know, I'm not saying there's no validity to it at all. But in comparison to his other crimes, I would say it's pretty relatively small. Anyway, the point is that, you know, I mean, I've heard tell from anti-fascist activists, and I'm sure you've heard the same thing, you know, when they're trying to oppose British fascists these days, like, you know, counter demonstrations against anti-immigrant campaigners and, you know, I don't even want to call them campaigners, just, you know, basically a bunch of fascist rabble outside our hotel trying to sort of attack refugees and asylum seekers, some of the most desperate people in the world fleeing wars that we've often caused in the first place, the British government. You know, anti-racist campaigners are trying to act against them, and they get the fascists coming back to them saying, oh, you lot, you all support, you know, you and Jeremy Corbyn, you're the real racists because you're anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
Well, they don't even know what it means most of the time. You know, yeah. They don't even understand the concept. They don't know what anti-Semitism is. And they probably, some of them are anti-Semitic themselves. You know, genuinely, actually really anti-Semitic. But this idea of anti-Semitism, most of the time when it's raised in this country, is actually not prejudice against Jews or hatred of Jews as Jews. It is, when it's being raised in this country, it's actually what is meant is opposition to Israel.
Yeah.
Is opposition to Zionism, the political ideology that dispossessed nearly a million Palestinians 75 years ago to found the racist state of Israel, the settler colonial entity. And so this is, you know, anti-Semitism is something that has happened historically.
Yeah.
You know, but today the whole concept has been completely devalued into basically a political weapon to oppose change, to preserve the status quo.
So what we're talking about is the formation of a trilateral security state, which consists of the US, Israel, and Britain, in which they outsource their problems to each other. So, for instance, your recent piece with Kit Clarenberg about the Palestinian Authority, the traitorous scumbags of the Palestinian Authority who kill Palestinians for Israel, that it is basically commanded by former figures of British intelligence who work for the Adam Smith Institute, which has contracts from the British government. So it's like the neoliberalization of spy corps. It's no longer government bodies, it's organizations that are outsourced by government bodies with names that kind of obscure what exactly their function is. Now, the interesting thing is you have the establishment of this trilateral state, which acts together in concert. Yes, there is spying on each other.
Yeah.
Yes, there is competition sometimes. But generally, there is a complete consensus about what their policy is. The British benefit from the creative ambiguities of acting as the troubled conscience of old school imperialists, and they're able to, and it's you know, that kind of leads us onto this question of the Roy Institute study of London in 2011, which I think is absolutely vital for all of us to have a good understanding of, because what it does is it creates a designation of pro-Palestinian activists and actors in London specifically, but in the country as a whole. Now, it designates critics on one hand of Israel and delegitimizers of Israel. Now, this is a room which contains solely delegitimizers, certainly. And you know, the influence of the Roy Institute is important.
It's huge.
Because when you even look at that study, particularly who is thanked in assisting in the production of that study.
Yeah, so
Jeremy Bowen. Is it Bowen or Bowen?
Bowen, yeah.
Bowen from the BBC. Yeah. Is thanked. So he contributed.
Middle East correspondent.
Middle East correspondent editor, I think.
Yeah.
For the BBC, contributed to the Roy Institute's study, which was Israel.
They interviewed a vast number of people,
But it took place, though, under the auspices of Israeli intelligence, basically, this study.
This is ostensibly a non-governmental think tank, but it's a cutout for the Israeli state.
And it says in it that we thank this particular figure from these government
ministries. It's very clear it's close to Israeli intelligence and ministries.
And funded by the same people that funded the same organizations that killed Corbynism.
Yeah.
Now, those designations exist for us, and they determine the type of policy which is aimed at us. So the delegitimizers are said to receive attack and sabotage wherever possible.
Yeah.
the critics now this is where we go in an interesting direction, because we the publicly aggressive lobby groups stood up and identified themselves. And this is one of, I think, the greatest failures of that period of time, is that appeasement became a knee-jerk, instinctive response by people who should know better. Yeah. Right?
Now, it wasn't even thought about. It was just done. Yeah.
Yes. So attack and sabotage is aimed at delegitimizers. Yeah. But critics are subject to sophisticated engagement strategies.
Yeah, these are, you're quoting it. This is the exact words.
Sophisticated engagement strategies. So then surely for us, our job is to actually analyze what are the sophisticated engagement strategies that are targeted at the critics, because what they say is they want to draw a wedge between the critics and the delegitimizers, separate them.
Yeah.
And this is basically what happened with Labour. Labour was told, be a critic, rely on international law, don't mention Zionism, talk about a two-state solution, embrace the Palestinian Authority. That is the pro-Palestinianism which is allowed in this country.
Yeah.
The delegitimizers read Electronic Intifada, donate to Palestine Action, and listen to my music. This is the wedge that was drawn. The critics are allowed to have membership of unions like GMB, or even receive funding from unions like GMB.
Yeah.
So then the question here is, understanding that there's this designation that has been applied to all of us, what happened next?
I think the sophisticated engagement strategies were the Jewish labor movement, and primarily the Jewish labor movement. The Labor Friends of Israel as well, to a lesser extent, but I don't think that was particularly sophisticated, because it was, I mean, look, they, you know, it, I think it was very clear who they were. Even though you weren't allowed to say they're a front group for the Israeli embassy, they blatantly were, and they were caught on camera by Al Jazeera saying that, essentially. Michael Rubin, who is now the full-time director of Labour Friends of Israel, was caught on camera by Al Jazeera saying that we, Joan Ryan, then the main MP leading Labour Friends of Israel, will talk to Shai most days. Shai Masot being ostensibly the representative of the Israeli embassy, but was actually essentially an Israeli intelligence agent for the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. So you have Labour Friends of Israel, its main MP, its leading MP, taking direction, essentially, most days from the Israeli embassy. Absolutely no doubt it's still doing the same thing now as a cutout for the Israeli embassy. And I think most people, you know, even on the left of the Labour Party, such as it is, would, at least privately, they'd probably concede, yeah, it's close to the Israeli embassy. But when it comes, the Jewish labor movement was more sophisticated, because in the sense of it was able to create more of an effective wedge, because then you've got people with political opportunists, no doubt, but people with a massive platform, and I'm talking about Owen Jones, especially, who has a massive mainstream platform. He's on the mainstream news all the time. He is the acceptable voice of the British left. He is who the mainstream media says is the acceptable extreme of the left. And he was engaged with this sophisticated engagement, and he was able to say, well, I support the Palestinians, I oppose the settlements, but I'm against all this anti-Semitism, and Ken Livingstone should be expelled from the Labour Party. For stating historical fact about Nazi Zionist collaboration in 1930.
Which has been extensively covered in Hebrew, in English. There's even, for example, on this issue of Nazi collaboration with the Israelis, there's been dramatizations and series made about it in Hebrew.
Yeah, it's a fact. It happened. And, you know, still nowadays, the Israeli state collaborates with far-right groups. It absolutely happens.
And if you look at the discourse between Jabotinsky and Ben-Gurion during that time, Ben-Gurion is referring to Jabotinsky's guys as brown shirts.
Yeah.
Jabotinsky's calling Ben Gurion a little Hitler.
Yeah.
Today, you have Israeli political analysts and even members of the Knesset calling Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir Nazis.
Yeah.
This discourse is completely permissible for some people.
Yeah.
But to speak in these terms, we are dancing all over the IHRA.
Yeah. No, it's just a fact, you know. I mean, you know, our friend David Miller, one of the world's foremost experts in the Israel lobby, I would say, certainly in this country. He fired from his job at Bristol University because he's an anti-Zionist, even though he was found completely innocent of anti-Semitism by independent investigations. He said the other day, at a talk he did the other day, he said something along the lines of, I don't know any other way than to speak the truth. And, you know, yeah, I identify with that because I think you have to speak the truth. And this is what happened. It's a fact. And there's no point in not talking about it. Like, it tells us something. The fact, it's really interesting, you know, you made a really good point about actually both main factions of the Zionist movement, the State of Israel now. They both sort of called each other fascists. That's interesting, you know, both sides called the ostensible Zionist left and the ostensible Zionist right. And they were kind of both right because those links did exist, you know. The right wing Zionists, the Lehi and the Irgun, the Lehi infamously actually reached out to the Nazi government to try and offer to strike an alliance, a formal alliance.
In 1941.
Yeah, during the Second World War.
And said, we'll go along with the Madagascar plan.
The Holocaust.
We'll fight on the German side in World War II.
Yeah, they offered that. You know, the Irgun was...
It's a historical fact. Argue with history. I mean, argue with the books that have been written about it. It's not us saying this. The document is there.
And you know, the ostensible Zionist left actually did a lot more than offer to. They actually collaborated with... the Nazis. So the German, I mean, I have a whole chapter about it in my book, so people can read all the details there. But and also there was the whole incidents, which we won't have time to get into, but of the Hungarian Zionist leaders who really collaborated with the Holocaust.
And Israel Katzner.
Yeah.
You know, this was a famous case in Israeli history. This was somebody who was very close to Ben-Gurion, and many perceive that his libel case that he launched against a gentleman who had been... I don't know if I actually remember wrongly, but I think the person that was handing out leaflets talking about his collaboration with the Nazis, this is Israel Katzner, I think his second name was Greenstein. So what happens is Israel Katzner is a high profile figure in the Israeli Labour Party, and he ends up trying to sue someone accusing him of collaborating with Eichmann and the Nazis.
Yeah.
And it goes into court, and it becomes very apparent that actually he did.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about that is that
he did it at the behest of the leadership of the Zionist movement at the time.
Rezo Katzner, also known as Israel Katzner, he didn't want to sue, but he was forced to by the leadership of the Labour Zionists because it was embarrassing for them. Long story short, the guy ended up being assassinated by the Shin Bet.
And the documents have been sealed for... Yeah. Almost 100 years.
The documents have been sealed, and they are, they're unlikely to ever be opened up until Palestine's liberated, if they still exist, you know, at that point. But they, so, you know, this guy became an embarrassment and he was offed, and because there was this big libel trial, and...
it's just a fact.
Yeah.
It's just a fact, you know, and Ken Livingstone mentioning it, how whatever your opinion is of the way a person says something, That's neither here nor there. It's historical fact. It's
and
historical
also, fact. Like, we're talking, okay, let's just say for the sake of argument, I don't agree, but just say for the sake of argument, what Kevin Livingston said was undiplomatic, because I've had some people sort of argue that. Okay,
it doesn't matter.
Okay, it was undiplomatic. What are you saying? He should have been expelled from the Labour Party for being undiplomatic.
No,
you know, we need a little less diplomacy and a bit more fire. I think.
And the thing was, is they were able to dehumanize him, stigmatize him, demonize him. You know, this someone who was a kind of an iconic figure of the Labour Party, historically mayor of London, you know, and they threw him to the wolves. And so really, the writing was on the wall from that point, that others would be sacrificed in the same way.
Yeah, this is it. Because this was the problem. Like, so they were attacking Jeremy Corbyn straight away. From the summer of 2015, they were attacking him on this issue straight away. They were accusing him of anti-Semitism, saying he was an extremist, yada, 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 on and on and on. At first, and this is what I try and trace the lines of in my book, because it would be impossible to recount every single instance of this. I tried to.
It was a factory. It was a factory. It was a smear factory.
Yeah, it really was. And it was impossible to keep up with it all. And in a way, you don't want to just debunk everything. You want to stop things from happening in the first place. But what I tried to show in the book, and I think I've succeeded in doing, is it started off attacking Jeremy Corbyn personally. He's a racist. He's an extremist. Blah 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 blah. It didn't fully take off at first. The reason being, Jeremy Corbyn is not a racist, he's not an anti-Semite, and people could see through it. And a lot of these things were debunked. And straight away, they were attacking him on saying, well, you know, oh, they were implying he was anti-Semitic. They were sort of trying to imply it and say, oh, well, you know, you called Hamas your friends and all this kind of things. Well, you know, Hamas is, whatever you think of it, is a popular Palestinian political party. And more importantly, it is the leader of the armed resistance, which Palestinians support. Whether people like that or not is irrelevant. It's not anti-Semitism.
And it's a right of all occupied people, according to multiple UN resolutions and democratically elected government.
Exactly. This is it. So it was sort of rolling on in the background, and it was an irritant and annoyance, and it made things difficult. But it didn't start to explode really until they decided, okay, that's not working. We'll try the same thing, but slightly differently. We'll go for the people around Corbyn.
Yeah.
We'll go for the people around Corbyn. So even before Ken Livingstone, it was this event, which a lot of people forget, but was really important, was what happened at Oxford University Labour Club. So I have a whole chapter, well, two chapters really, about what happened here in my book, and people can read all the details there. But in a nutshell, at Oxford University Labour Club, there was an allegation, and it became a big national story. And it even had international dimensions. There was a prominent columnist in the New York Times who wrote a column about it, about anti-Semitism of the left. And the story in the national press was the leader or the co-chair of the Oxford University Labour Club, you know, student, it's a fancy name for a student society, Labour Party student society, had quit his position because of anti-Semitism. There's a terrible, you know, they announced the investigation. Ed Miliband, the former leader of the Labour Party, cancelled a planned speaking event at Oxford University Labour Club. It was on all these headlines. It was a terrible scandal. But there was no basis to it. There was no evidence. There was no, you know, no one asked any questions about it. You know, there was no evidence. Like, and so when the guy, his name was Alex Chalmers, he posted his resignation statement on Facebook about it. You know, I've quote from it in my book. I've still got the screenshots now, although it's deleted. What he actually said was, I've resigned. Yes, he accused people of anti-Semitism, but there was nothing specific. There was no specific allegations, except what he said was, oh, they voted in favor of Israel Apartheid Week.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Labour Club is deciding that it's going to campaign for Palestinian equality
and raise awareness of Israeli apartheid. But instead of being able to do that, he's ignited this big national scandal over a completely manufactured and invented idea of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. And this was really, really important, not just for that one story, which was just one of many stories, but it really started for two main reasons. It started this trend of people around Jeremy Corbyn being attacked, and it spread it to the wider movement. And that meant that, you know, obviously the Corbyn and his people were going to protect Corbyn, but then if there was, you know, some pro Corbyn student at the Labour, are they going to protect him? Probably not. They probably might consider him expendable. And so people around Corbyn started to be picked off one by one by one by one. And that was ultimately, in the end, a few years later, led to the political assassination of Jeremy Corbyn himself and the decapitation of the movement.
It was a war of attrition.
It was a war of attrition, absolutely. And, you know, you have to hand it to the enemy, to the Israel and its lobby. They did that successfully. You know, they did. They didn't give it up. You know, even in the Al Jazeera documentary, the undercover Al Jazeera documentary, which exposed this Israeli, effectively an Israeli intelligence agent, an Israeli spy, Shai Masot, he said it. He said, "Don't let it go." When he was asked for advice about Jackie Walker, who was one of these pro Corbyn people picked off. Don't let it go. Just keep on and on and on and on. And they did do that. So the second reason why that was important in the smear campaign was because what it started was the first investigation, the first of many, many investigations into so-called anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. I lost, I count them up in my book. I believe it's about 6 or 7 different investigations.
Yeah.
And that was the first one. It was the Labour students' investigation. It was never published. It was never officially endorsed. It was kind of hushed up, but I did manage to obtain it.
Yeah,
I didn't publish it. I published some extracts from it. I didn't publish it because it was a completely libelous document.
Yeah.
It just there was stuff in it that I managed to show was completely made up.
So I have a question here now.
And sorry, one more thing on that. The guy who wrote it was then soon after given a job in Labour Friends of Israel. And he admitted to working closely with Shai Masot.
There you go.
So
now give us, Asa, where, because what people will say we do is we assume a lack of agency. So they say, okay, these groups might be pro-Israel, but they personally feel aggrieved by what they deem to be anti-Semitism. They say to us, where's your proof this is being directed by the political unit, the alleged state of Israel? Break down for us where that issue of direction comes into it. Because there's things that, I'm happy to play wingman on this answer, but I'd love to hear you break down
what
first.
I would say to that, right, is I'm sure CIA agents feel personally aggrieved that whatever justification comes in their mind that American freedom is being crushed in Venezuela.
But specifically in this case, break it down for us.
So, what I would say is, of course, the people in these groups, they probably believe a lot of what they say.
Yeah.
I don't think they believe everything they say.
Well, I mean, in a way, you just gave me an example with Shai Masood, and he's talking about don't ever drop it. This is a directive given by an Israeli government official.
It's they work together, and these groups, these pro-Israel groups. So this whole idea of you're taking away their agency, I just think is a load of rubbish because it is proven and shown that they act in close coordination with, that's the whole point. Why would you have a pro-Israel group if it's not going to work closely with the state of Israel?
You know, one of the pictures that I love is is the picture that you at Electronic Intifada published of Ella Rose next to, in front of David Cameron, next to Israeli embassy personnel. Probably the Israeli ambassador, I think, at the time.
I think that
when
was...
she worked there. You know who else was in the picture? The convicted fraudster, Gerald Ronson.
Right.
So there's a united front being shown here of Israeli embassy employees, as well as the head of the CST.
I think that photo was actually the heads of the different Israel lobby groups. CST, right. Board of Deputies, JLC, and so forth. There was another picture where she was posing with the former ambassador and with Jeremy Newmark.
Yeah.
But that in itself tells you something, that these groups are so intermingled.
Yeah, they act concert.
They literally have revolving doors between them. So she's gone, she worked in the Israeli embassy, and she's gone straight from the Israeli embassy to the Jewish labor movement.
And tell us about the Board of Deputies Trustees Report 2020.
Yeah, so the Board of Deputies is Board of Deputies of British Jews. It's a very old organization. It started in the 18th century, I believe. But right up until the 1940s, it was anti-Zionist. But in the 1940s, it was essentially a hostile takeover by the Zionist movement. And I think this is something we don't know enough about, actually. And if you read Paul Kellerman's book, which I relied on quite extensively, actually, for my book, brilliant Manchester University academic, he wrote a definitive study of the British left and Zionism, his subtitle, History of a Divorce. It's a really good book. It's really readable. You know, there's a lot of academics who are frankly terrible writers. Mm. He's not one of them. He's a good writer as well as being a good researcher. In that, he explains, and this has been explained by other, by some, anti-Zionist academics and so forth, of the concept of in Zionism, of the conquests of Zionism. And the way Paul Kellerman explains is there was three conquests central to the success of Zionism. Number one was the conquest of labor. Number two was a conquest of land. And number three was a conquest of community, of a conquest of communities, which is a little bit more complex, and we'll come to. The first one, the complex of labor, was essentially replacing Palestine, coming to Palestine, colonizing Palestine, and getting rid of Palestinian workers.
And that's where you get the muscular kibbutzism.
Yeah.
To till the soil.
Zionism, yeah. Getting rid of the Palestinian workers, replacing them with Jewish workers, colonists. Number two, conquest of land, physical conquest of the land.
Yeah.
Number three was the conquest of communities. Now, that's more complex because the first two are more about Palestine. Number three is the conquest of what is meant by conquest of communities is the conquest of Jewish communities in Europe.
And in Iraq. And in
around the world. And what was meant by that was taking over the institutions, the institutional bodies of world Jewry, and conquering them for Zionism. And that was, to a large extent, outside of religious ultra-Orthodox communities and outside of, secular left-wing anti-Zionists, that was done to a very large extent. And so this is a long way to go about saying that the Board of Deputies of British Jews essentially claims to represent all Jews, but is actually really, in large part, an Israel lobby organization. That's what it spends most of its time doing. And the document that you mentioned spells that out. It says we have a, quote, close working relationship with the Embassy of Israel, including the Israeli military spokesman and the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, which is essentially an Israel. Well, it's now been supposedly disbanded, but in reality folded into other ministries. But it was really a semi-covert Israeli sabotage agency precisely for this kind of Reut Institute to advise stuff that you mentioned. Since 2009 and a series of reports by the Reut Institute starting in around about 2009, 2010, 2011, the recommended strategy was, quote, as you said, sabotage and attack hubs of what they call delegitimization in the West, and they especially focused on London and other, what they regarded as hubs of delegitimization, Palestine Solidarity, centers of Palestine Solidarity around the world.
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the conquest of communities. There's an amazing book by Abbas Shiblaq called The Law of Zion, and it's looks in intense detail at the campaign in Iraq to get what was referred to as Zionist emissary by Zionist emissaries at that time as good human material. Mm. So the Iraqi Jewish community, ancient community, had attained a certain level of not only political but economic power in Iraq throughout the British mandate of Mesopotamia, had former finance minister, prominent member of the Iraqi Jewish community, to aid in what Yusuf al-Kabir, who was an Iraqi Jewish lawyer in the 30s, their militant archaeology. That's what he called Zionism, a form of militant archaeology. And that campaign is fascinating because not only does it involve the provision of key social assistance that one might imagine, it even ends up in seemingly, in Shiblaq's book, he makes the claim that both the British Embassy, the US Embassy, and the Iraqi government had a consensus that the bombing of synagogues in Iraq, including cafes that were frequented by Jewish people, had taken place by Israeli intelligence in 1951, because they'd been able to pass something called the denaturalization law. So they had Tawfiq al-Suwaidi, somebody who they'd been cultivating at least since the 20s and 30s. So at one point, Tawfiq al-Suwaidi was an Iraqi political figure who went on to be prime minister in 1951. Now, he was somebody who had shown a willingness to carry out a population transfer. This was back in the 20s and the 30s, whereby Iraqi Jews would be sent to Palestine and Palestinians would be taken into Iraq.
Yeah, it was a long-standing plan of Zionism was to expel population transfer. Palestinians to Iraq. Yeah.
And so what he then did in 51 was he passed this law which would allow Iraqi Jews to leave their Iraqi citizenship, give up their property and anything they owned, and become Israelis, right? Now, what Abbas Shiblaq does in this book is he tracks the exact figures of people month by month that took up this offer. And so he looks at the first 3 months when the denaturalization law was passed, and it's very small uptake.
Yeah.
You know, from the centers like Basra and Baghdad, which had ancient... The state had been at war with, you know, the period of 48 and the war with, you know, the governmental and monarchy betrayal in some ways had been popular, you know, the Iraq's participation in the war in Palestine was widely supported in Iraqi society. Legislation had been passed, you know, despite the fact that the government, like I say, had ultimately fallen in line with the Hashemite position, which was to facilitate Israel, basically. Yeah. They had passed legislation against Zionism in the society in general. However, the interesting thing is that whether it was the third or the fourth month, I can't remember exactly, but it was the month when the turning point happened, these bombings took place. Then people leave, over 100,000 people leave. But then when they get to Palestine, they find themselves into, and there's an amazing documentary about Insa Baghdad, which speaks to some of these people that had taken this journey. And they say that when we got to Palestine, we were left in camps, and the Israelis sprayed us with DDT when we got off the plane, and we had to, you know, and then this goes into the stratification within Israeli society on racial lines.
Zionism was racist against, you know, against Jews as well, Jews who were from Arab countries. They considered them to be subhuman, basically.
And Ellen Shohat sort of posits these people as Arab Jewish victims of Zionism, Arab Jewish victims of Zionism. But, you know, obviously we do know that there's a heavy, heavy contingent supporting the most right-wing Zionist policies within these communities now, of what they call the Mizrachim. But, you know, at that particular time, this was a group of people viewed as useful human material. But it's just really interesting the way that that conquest of communities manifested in different contexts. You had the situation in Egypt, for example. Lavon, the Israeli Minister of Defense. Now, this is an interesting one, because it's not like Iraq. The Israeli government take credit for it. So during Abdel Nasser's time, you have bombs placed at positions of U.S. importance, but also positions of Jewish importance in Egypt by Israeli intelligence, to the extent that Lavon even got an award by the Israeli government for this operation.
Yeah, it's called the Lavon Affair in Israel because it all came out, you know, in Israel like some years later, and there was some scandal over it, but it wasn't the fact that the Israeli state had carried out this massive terror operation against primarily Jewish targets in Egypt. As a false flag, in order to basically provoke war with Egypt. That wasn't the scandal. The scandal was some relatively minor political thing. I forget all the details of it now, but it was just they hadn't done it effectively enough or something like that. But that all came out and that was all proven. But it's still now not really considered to be much of a problem. You know, it's kind of a forgotten bit of history. The Jewish community in Egypt was relatively small, I think, but the Iraqi Jewish community was fairly large, and it was it was very ancient as well, you know. So, I think that is a massive... I mean, I personally have no doubt whatsoever that Mossad was behind those bombings of synagogues and other Jewish community areas in Iraq. They absolutely drove all that. I think I saw an interview with the academic Avi Schleim, who's a really interesting and impressive historian. Who, he's often described as Israeli. I would admit, to me, he's an Iraqi Jew. That's it. He's an interesting character because I think he's kind of moved more anti-Zionist over the years. But anyway, that's as may be. But the point is, his background is from Iraq. I think he might have even been born in Iraq. Certainly his parents were.
Yeah.
He did an interview some years ago with Azam Tamimi, and he asked him about these incidents.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, what, have you found anything in the archives about this? And he said, well, I did check the Israeli archives, but I couldn't find any concrete evidence of this. But he said, every single member of my family believes that was done by the Mossad.
Yeah.
So that is widely known, and, you know, that is widely known within those communities.
I mean,
and so it's interesting. What I think that is something that will probably come out in the future.
And then with the Yemeni community.
This is the other thing.
You know,
children were kidnapped, literally kidnapped by white Jewish families.
Yes.
By the state.
Yes.
By the Israeli
and
state.
And the parents were shown graves. So understand, we're talking about Yemeni Jewish population that is, another by hook ancient, or by crook, yeah. another ancient population, by hook or by crook, is lured into Israel. The children were kidnapped from these Yemeni families.
It's another scandal in Israel, which is not talked about in the West.
And the Yemeni families were told, your children died in birth, and were shown graves for children who were not dead and who had been kidnapped and taken into Ashkenazi. You know, I mean, this is white supremacy. What do you want to call it? It's white supremacy.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
You know, what I'm sort of partly interested in as well, when you were talking about the far right aspect, is, you know, we can't forget that Tommy Robinson, he was a Shulman fellow at the, you know, because the far right were also making leaps and bounds during this time. You know, until Tommy Robinson was taken off of social media, he was reaching millions of people daily through social media.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not one of these people that sort of gets the state to then shut down people whose opinions I don't agree with. But when you look at also his funding, and you understand that, okay, he was a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. Okay, yeah. David Horowitz, well-known Israel lobbyist. That's a fact. Robert Shillman, though, was on the board of the Friends of the IDF at the same time as he was given, according to Lucy Brown, £10,000 or dollars a month to Tommy Robinson as a Shillman fellow, which was a position also shared by Ben Shapiro. Tommy Robinson then goes through his court situation. Who pays his legal fees? The Middle East Forum. Who leads the Middle East Forum? Greg Roman, who's a former employee of the Israeli Ministry of Defense and the Israeli Foreign Ministry. So in a way, there's direct role of people involved with the mechanics of the Israeli state pushing Tommy Robinson and his ideas in British society. You look at Katie Hopkins. In a way, there was a bit of a split here because at one point the Board of Deputies, you know, issued statements against Katie Hopkins, but Katie Hopkins received a huge amount of support inside occupied Jerusalem by the Israeli mayor of Jerusalem, who's now gone on to a higher government position under the Netanyahu government. And Katie Hopkins was also supported by David Horowitz Freedom Center. So in a way, you've got, you know, when we were talking earlier about racism, it's like we have had an explicitly Islamophobic foreign policy as long as I've been alive. Mm. There's been people that I consider myself to have an affinity with on the other side of British government and US government and Israeli government, which is the trilateral security state, which that lurches over us, on the bottom of those bombs. Mm. So this is state-sanctioned racism that is just the norm. And yet, at the same time, we're seeing an opportunity for us to widen political participation and decision-making in the society, and we're the ones called the racists, when we've been working all these years against the racism which has hurt us and hurt our families.
Yeah. Yeah, this is where we reached to, and this is why it was such a powerful weapon, because it really got to people. And, you know, people sometimes say to me, well, was it all the Israel lobby? Wasn't it Brexit? I'm not saying it was all the Israel lobby. That's not the point. The point is that this was the most damaging weapon that was used against this popular movement in a way that Brexit wasn't. And because to be, you know, okay, people have different, you know, opinions over Brexit. At the end of the day, so what? The point is Jeremy Corbyn was being attacked, personally attacked, as something that actually got to his heart, which was, oh, you're racist. You know, and I think he probably started to believe, not that he was racist, but, oh, maybe there's something in all this and maybe I need to do something about it. And this was the problem. You know, this was the real problem. So because
they were beating a delegitimizer into a critic.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that was the project, absolutely, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was incredibly damaging, because ultimately it was divide and rule, and it was, like you said, it was what the Rayot Institute called the wedge strategy.
Yeah.
Because they know, this is why sabotage and attack was so important for them. It wasn't winning hearts and minds.
No, but that's also
because they knew they can't.
And they've always, you know, the Zionist movement has always been top heavy.
Yeah.
It's always been top heavy because it's never been massively successful in an organic grassroots way. It has always had
this
to use
manipulation. This is why Labour Friends of Israel doesn't have a membership.
Yeah.
If you look, people informally say, oh, they're a member of Labour Friends of Israel. If you go onto Labour Friends of Israel website and you try to join as a member, you can't. There's no membership form. Because they in the past, they did have members decades ago. But again, this is something Paul Kellerman talks about. They had to wrap it up because they didn't have enough people supporting them. Yeah. Instead, they get supporters. Who are the supporters? They're MPs, they're lords. You know, they're these prominent figures within the Labour Party.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's it shows they don't have the people on their side. They don't have any kind of mass movement. All they have is lobbying, money, and delegitimization, and just dirty tactics and smears, essentially. And they do have a lot of money. This is a fact. And we don't talk about it enough. Part of the reason we don't talk about it enough, because we don't know enough about it, because it's completely opaque.
Yeah.
But Shai Mossad's infamous £1 million.
Where was it going?
Where did it go? We don't know. We still don't know. They claim it was for trips for young people to Israel.
Yeah. But I mean, that's a drop in the ocean.
Yeah.
You know, £1 million when we think of across these years, what has flown in and out, you know, and there's passed through organizations. This is the truth.
And I'm sure they buy MPs. I'm sure they do. But, because not all of these people, like, who was Joan Ryan anyway?
Yeah.
And who is this guy? What is it? Steve? I can't remember any of their names. Who is Joan Ryan's successor? I think his name's Steve Reed.
Yeah.
Who is he? No one's heard of him.
Yeah. But here's the question then, Asa, is how does that lead us into your latest scoop, which is Gary Lubner?
Yeah, so the one of the big cleavages within the Corbyn years and one of the potentials for change that we saw that you talked about at the beginning was that, you know, one of the things that was changed, that did briefly change in the Labour Party, was the potential to involve a mass movement of people, you know, for good, for some sort of positive change in the country. And one of the ways that that would have been done, and that did start to happen to an extent, was to remove the corporate lobbying money from politics and to replace it with people power. And, you know, Jeremy Corbyn ultimately left the Labour Party in very good financial shape. And that was because it was supported by a mass movement of members, which was nearing 600,000 people at its height. You know, it was reaching record levels in the Labour Party. You know, under Tony Blair, the Labour Party became this corporate husk, which was financed by major corporate donors, essentially. The leading light of which, of course, was Michael Levy, infamously known as Lord Cashpoint, because he was himself a donor to Tony Blair's neoliberal Labour Party. But more importantly, he rallied other big businessmen to support Labour, the New Labour Project. And he was a very influential Israel lobbyist. And so, you know, that all fed the direction of neoliberal pro-war, pro-Israel Labour under Tony Blair. And the Corbyn years, that started to change because just the very fact that Corbyn was in charge of it meant all these big donors started pulling out. And some of them actually had made loans, which was really interesting. They'd made loans to the Labour Party. Well, they started to call those loans in when Corbyn came in. And they were all making a big fuss about, oh, we're not going to donate anymore. And, you know, Corbyn just said, okay, good. You know, so that was good. But the problem, of course, now is that 200,000 people who joined the Labour Party to vote for Corbyn have now been essentially kicked out or pushed out of the Labour Party in some way by the purges of the membership that have happened under Keir Starmer. And that really, let's be honest, began in the Corbyn years. Now, you know, as especially targeting the pro-Palestinian left, Palestine Solidarity activists and so forth. Now, those 200,000 people have also taken their membership fees with them. So this was what was replacing the corporate donors, was just small donors, individual people, giving their monthly, whatever it was, £5 or £6 or whatever it was. And then at election time, rallying around, putting in £20, whatever it needed. And that was incredibly successful. You know, it was never talked about and, you know, we saw similar things happen with other insurgent campaigns like Bernie Sanders and so forth. That people power is now gone, and the Blairites are back in. And so Keir Starmer is looking for big donors again, and he's bringing them back in. And it was announced earlier this month by the Financial Times, which basically did a puff piece interview with this guy, that one of these big donors, and potentially the biggest one, is going to be a man called Gary Lubner. Now, Gary Lubner, you know, I read the article. It didn't say that he was an Israel lobbyist, but I thought, yeah, let me look the guy up. I bet he is. And sure, lo and behold, he is an active donor and financier of the Israel lobby in this country and, you know, no doubt all over the world. He's certainly a long-term funder of the UJIA, which is the United Jewish Israel Appeal, which sends young people, mostly Jewish young people, on trips to propaganda trips to Israel to basically indoctrinate them into Zionism.
And where they've been found to stay in illegal settlements.
In illegal settlements as well. So this is, and it's actually very closely tied to the state of Israel itself. So he's a long-term supporter of that. But what was also interesting in this story was that what I found was that Gary Lubner is a South African. So, but he's lived in this country for a good number of years now. Since he began working, well, rewind the story a bit. The interesting part is he was a South African. He is a South African. He is basically the scion of a very rich family, a very rich white South African family, which ran a company, a family firm, which was later, you know, at certain points was worth billions, and was doing billions in sales. It started off as a plate glass firm, a windshields firm. And actually, the company now still owns the brand in Britain. It owns brands all over the world, but the most famous brand in Britain is Autoglass, which, you know, if your windscreen gets broken by damage or thief or whatever, you get your windscreen replaced. Well, this company started in South Africa, and it made a huge amount of money, expanded into construction and all kinds of areas. It was known as the PG Group. And Gary Lubner was later in charge as CEO of Belron, its international arm, which acquired all these brand names all over the world or started them. I'm not sure of all the details, including Autoglass. Now, PG Group was, and this was something that I was informed about by Andrew Feinstein, former ANC MP in South Africa. You know, it would be familiar to lots of viewers of your podcast. He told me that the Lubner family, were very well known in South Africa as sanctions busters during the South African apartheid regime. And it was really interesting what I found out on it. So, this is not a case of blaming the son for the sins of the fathers. That's not what it was. So the company, PG Group, was owned and run by Ronnie Lubner, who was Gary Lubner's father, and also his brother, Bertie Lubner, so Gary Lubner's uncle. They're relatives, but that it was a family firm, and Gary Lubner went into the family business. He became an accountant, and through the 80s, through this sanctions busting period, he was an accountant for the firm, and he went on to run the CEO. Of course, later now, in the post-apartheid era, he's claiming that he was the, like a lot of white South Africans, he, you know, claims to have been against apartheid. Well, the fact is that, you know, something like 90% of white South Africans voted in favor of apartheid. So, you know, these kinds of claims, false claims of, oh, I was against it all along, are quite common, unfortunately. But the fact is, he made his millions off a company that played an active role in supporting the South African apartheid regime's white supremacist regime. So, for example, Bertie and Ronnie Lubner, they personally donated to the ruling National Party, to the Prime Minister in the early 80s, P.W. Botha, who, let's not forget, was at one point in the 1940s, was involved in the South African Nazi group, an explicitly pro-Hitler organization. He later left it, but he was a white supremacist his whole life. There's no doubt about that. And he ran a very viciously white supremacist, racist regime at a time when there was just a really brutal regime in South Africa. A military dictatorship, and essentially claimed to be a democracy, but it wasn't. Quite similar to apartheid Israel in a lot of ways. And also Ronnie and Bertie Lubner, they also offered $15 million to start a lobby group, a pro-apartheid lobby group in Washington, D.C., on behalf of the regime. And this all came out about 5 or 6 years ago in South Africa, but very well reported in South Africa, and it's all there to see. And so it's quite fitting in a way that this man would be funding the Labour Party in Britain of today, because the leader of the Labour Party today has made it clear that his only issue that he's really passionate about is supporting apartheid Israel. He has called himself a supporter of Zionism without qualification. That was his pitch when he was running. That was his pitch to the Israel lobby when he was running for leader of the Labour Party. And so it is Keir Starmer who has made this his kind of emblematic issue. And Gary Lubner did an interview with the Puff Piece interview with the, well, it was basically a press release for Gary Lubner in the Financial Times. And he, you know, he was claiming in the article, oh, under Corbyn, there was all this anti-Semitism in the party and my youngest son was attacked with it. And it's great that Keir Starmer has thrown them all out, to his credit. So the point is now is to secure the Labour Party for the future, for the corporate interests, for the Israel lobby, and to ensure that nothing like Corbynism can ever, ever happen again in the Labour Party, and that the status quo is maintained indefinitely.
And that is a fantastic way to wrap us up today. We are unfortunately out of time. Thank you so much, Asa. I recommend everybody pick up the book now if you can. What's its latest position on Amazon?
Oh, yeah, I was just checking the Amazon charts, Amazon UK charts on the way over, and it was at number 400 and something. So
in the entire world?
On Amazon UK. So
right.
You know, it's a modest position, but it's outselling at some other people, and it's currently outselling David Baddiel. You know, look, it's a chart position. It can change. Look, I don't have the institute. It's a small radical publisher. I don't have the institutional support. I've had no mainstream media coverage, and I think the book is doing well. And you know, I want to thank everyone who's bought it, because there is a lot of goodwill for the book, and people want to read the book, and they're glad to just really, I think, read what happened.
Yeah,
you know, people are still kind of in shell shock about what happened,
because
was so massive.
Yeah.
And they're glad to just kind of be vindicated of, yeah, this did actually happen. I'm not
exactly
going, I'm not going nuts.
Exactly,
you know, this is all documented.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us, Asa. Thank you to the crew for making this happen today. Please join us next time on Mint Press. And by the way, we have a funding drive about to be launched. We hope that you can support us. You know, we are an independent media organization at a time where we are conspired against by different structures of power that we study. They work to get us deplatformed from PayPal and from other places too. So for us to keep doing this kind of journalism and to keep exposing those lobby groups and aspects of the military industrial complex, we need your support. For us to cover the stories that affect you in your life, we need your support. So we hope that after viewing this fantastic episode with Asa, to support us and people like Asa, you can donate to Mint Press as part of the new funder drive. Thank you so much for joining us on The Watchdog. Thank you, Asa. I appreciate you coming.